Welcome, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. 45 million people in the United States owe more than $1.7 trillion in student debt. And for these millions of individuals and families, this student debt is crushing. It can delay everything from buying a home to saving for retirement. And student debt is continuing to worsen economic inequality and the racial wealth gap. According to CNBC, student debt has increased by over 100% over the past decade, thanks to the skyrocketing cost of tuition in both public and private colleges and universities. According to College Board, nearly 60% of undergrads have to take out a student loan. Now, during his campaign for president, President Biden promised to forgive at least $10,000 in federal student loans per person. But advocates and progressive Democrats have been pushing him to go further. In February, Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer drafted a plan asking Biden to forgive at least $50,000 in debt for borrowers. And it was co-sponsored by over 50 members in the House and over 325 grassroots groups. It would make 36 million borrowers debt-free. Now, if you have a student debt story that you would like to share, or if you have a comment about what you would like to see the Biden administration do when it comes to student loan forgiveness, we would love to hear from you on today's program. You can join this conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. You can also reach us via Twitter, and our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. Well, to discuss this topic and get the latest, we're pleased to be joined by two guests. First, we have Natalia Abrams. She's president and co-founder of Student Debt Crisis, a nonprofit organization dedicated to student loan debt reform. Natalia has been working on this issue for a decade. Natalia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ethan. Thank you for having us, or having me.
No, glad you're both with us. And we're also joined by Whitney Barkley Denny. She's senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, a nonprofit research and policy group whose purpose is to push for policies that curb predatory lending. And Whitney works with state legislators, attorneys general, and governors to fight predatory lending, exploitative student loan practices, and unscrupulous debt collectors. Whitney, welcome to Your Call. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much, Ethan. It's great to be here.
So to put all of this in perspective, Natalia, I wanted to start with you. The $1.7 trillion in student loan debt is bigger than all credit card and auto loan debt. And this number is just growing and growing. So to start with the big picture here, what are the economic ramifications of our student debt crisis? Can you tell us how you're seeing this play out across the country?
Yes. And, you know, it is very much a student debt crisis. To be clear, when we talk about student debt, we're talking about debt that's held by, you know, students, that student loan borrowers, parents. Parent loans are included in this. We see that this is a multi-generational crisis. We see that this is, you know, a racial equity crisis, that we're, you know, harming people that have, you know, wanted to get better their lives, better their careers, and only to be stuck with a mountain of student debt. Of that 1.7, which is almost 1.8 trillion, that's held by 45 million Americans, which we call student loan borrowers. We see, you know, that their lack of ability to purchase homes, to start families, really this domino effect that happens when you exit school and then you're looking at, you know, an average of $30,000 per person, but at Student Debt Crisis, we work with so many borrowers that owe $100,000, $200,000. And interest is what, you know, one of the things that is killing them, along with the servicing errors that we see all the time from the companies that are supposed to help you pay back your student loan, and in fact, create so many obstacles that they often charge you tens of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of your loan in inaccuracies and mistakes.
So it's clearly just a devastating burden for many people to carry. And Whitney, I wanted to ask you a similar question. I mean, what are you seeing in terms of the impacts of all the student debt, and particularly on the economic side of things? I mean, many economists agree that it's really holding the economy back to have all this debt out there, preventing people from buying homes, saving for retirement, and so much more. So did you want to comment on that?
Absolutely. Well, first, let me say I just co-sign everything Natalia shared. We definitely agree on the effects of student loans on the wider economy. I want to point out two things. One is who we're talking about. I think there is a misconception that we're talking about rich kids with graduate degrees when we talk about canceling student loan debt. I assure you that rich people do not need to take out student loans in order to go to college. We are talking about people who are middle class, people who are working class, people who are first generation. And in particular, as Natalia pointed out, we're talking about a crisis within Black America and Black communities. One of the most terrible things that I have learned in doing this work is that student loan debt is actually increasing the racial wealth gap. Education and having to borrow for education is actually having a wealth stripping effect in the Black community because Black borrowers borrow more. They take longer to repay because of discrimination in the labor market. And when they do repay, they end up having paid a lot more because of the time that it takes them to repay. They're also more likely to default than white borrowers. And so this is, as Natalia said, it's a large crisis, but it's also a crisis that is really focused in specific communities. And I think that's one of the ironies. You know, not only did President Biden promise to cancel at least $10,000 in student loan debt, but he promised to have an administration that really worked on racial equity as a national crisis and a national issue. And student loan debt is a big part of that.
Absolutely. Well, and Natalia, I know you work closely with folks who have student debt. I'm wondering if you could just shed a little light on the average amount of student debt that borrowers owe. What's the price tag today on this?
Yeah, and I think it very much varies per borrower. We're around $30,000 per borrower. It depends on kind of what cross-section you're looking at. Is it recent graduates? Is it all the debt combined? That's about a $400 monthly payment, which are, you know, student loan payments. Most of them, federal loans, are on pause right now. But as I said, that is typically just for undergraduate education. Many of the borrowers that go on to graduate school and beyond, you know, we're seeing price tags of $100,000, $200,000 and more.
Right. So it's almost like some people like in having another rent payment. I saw one survey that found average monthly payments at about $1,200. So that information hopefully could put this in perspective for those who aren't suffering from this this debt burden. But I do want to point out some good news that during the pandemic, more than 20 million borrowers have not had to pay back their loans. And that's been a huge relief for many. In March of 2020, the CARES Act that Congress passed put all federal student loan payments in forbearance and set the interest rate to 0%. And the Department of Education just extended that through January 31st of next year, as I mentioned in the introduction. Whitney, I know this has been life-saving for people who have lost their jobs during the pandemic, but it's also been life-changing for people who finally have been able to put a dent in their debt because the interest isn't accumulating. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Absolutely. We definitely have seen that there are folks who are and have been able to pay down on their student loans during the pandemic. One thing that's interesting, though, is that the National Consumer Law Center, along with CRL, got some information from Navient, one of the largest student loan servicers in the country, to see how folks who were on income-driven repayment plans were doing in the pandemic, people who particularly were paying on their student loan debt. And what we found is that generally they actually weren't making a dent in their student loan debt at all. Mm-hmm. And that's because they had so much interest accrued. They had so, their monthly payments weren't even getting close to touching their principal and interest, that even in making these 0% payments during this time when there's this pause, they still weren't seeing a reduction in the overall student loan debt that they owed. So I think that this has been a really good thing. We certainly support continuing to extend the student loan pause. I don't believe that any of us on this call think the pandemic is going to be over and the economy recovered by the end of January when payments resume. But I think it's important to keep in mind that people's debt is so out of control and they have so much more often than they graduated with, that even this time period, this year and a half or year and some months of being able to pay with zero interest hasn't made a dent in their overall student loan burden.
So not the the at least temporary panacea that some might have hoped. And I should also point out that people with private loans or people who refinance their loans with private services have not been in this forbearance period. But Natalia, I wanted to follow up on this point. A Bloomberg Businessweek analysis found that U.S. student loan borrowers are only paying down about 1% of their federal debt every year because most of it's going towards paying down interest. Is that accurate? Is that pretty much summing up with the crisis that we're facing right now?
Well, I don't want it to be watered down to we're just facing an interest crisis, because we are, you know, facing a crisis of the complete loan. And, you know, just to add to what Whitney was saying with the payment pause, I think the only thing that's really, one of the only things that's been really good that's come out of it is people have experienced what it's like to have their loans temporarily canceled, and it has increased the public support to cancel student debt. And we've seen that in our own polling numbers. I apologize. What was your question?
Well, just basically asking if that is a pretty accurate summary that.
Interest crisis. What I think people don't know is there's so much interest, like compounding and capitalizing within student loan debts, especially if you fall into a forbearance, you don't learn about these repayment programs, your interest gets compounded then capitalized, and you're essentially just paying interest on interest. And, you know, so many people are very shocked, and that's why you can easily pay off the initial amount of your loan and still owe, you know, that amount or double after 10 or 20 years. And you mentioned a mortgage. This is absolutely becoming a mortgage for so many individuals, where, you know, hardly any borrowers I speak to are able to pay back in the 10-year standard time. It's due to all of that interest that they end up paying over 20 or 30 years or more.
Well, and Natalia Abrams, just staying with you, what do you make of what I just pointed out, that for people with private loans or who refinance their loans through private services haven't been able to take advantage of this forbearance period? What is your reaction to that?
I think we need to fight for all loans. I understand that, you know, a majority of people there's more federal loans out there in terms of the portfolio. It's heavily weighted with federal loans, but the people with private loans, and I know Whitney works a lot with borrowers in these same positions, so incredibly predatory. While the whole system is with private loans, we see, you know, interest rates of 10% or more, no flexibility with repayments, and we have to do something, you know, parity for private loans as well.
And Whitney, what's your organization, Center for Responsible Lending? Do you have a position on folks who aren't able to take advantage of this forbearance because of their the private source of their loan or refinancing?
Absolutely. We agree with Natalia and Student Debt Crisis that we want to see some way to make sure that we can give some benefit to folks who have private student loans. And that may come down, Ethan, to doing something like, you know, allowing bankruptcy on all student loans that would let people get out from under that. I don't want to get ahead of our conversation, but that's certainly something that we could apply to private student loan borrowers as well as federal student loan borrowers without many problems legally.
All right. And I wanted to get a few more facts out there about who exactly has student loans. According to the Pew Research Center, it's about 1 in 3 adults under the age of 30 have student loans. And as a generation, millennials have the greatest amount of outstanding debt. BuzzFeed had a piece called Young People Coping with Mounting Debt, say no one has their backs. The pandemic has left them on the brink of ruin. And they spoke with several first-gen college students who had to front the cost of education on their own and didn't have resources to help. Natalia, I know you work closely with these types of borrowers. Can you discuss particularly how this debt crisis is impacting young people today as they're just trying to start out in their lives?
Oh, I think it's so discouraging, right? You know, that you go to school to expand your mind, to possibly better yourself in your career. And then by the time you're looking to your first payment, which is 6 months after graduation, going back to our initial conversation, you've already accrued interest. You already owe more than you borrowed. Not to mention the, you know, news out there has been really confusing on what type of repayment programs are out there. If, for example, public service loan forgiveness is a real thing, it is. But, you know, over the past few years, through the thick of this crisis, I think it's been incredibly discouraging for young borrowers. And we know that, you know, salaries are not what they should be, and definitely not commensurate with the cost of college when people are paying, you know, upwards of $35,000 for room and board to go to a state school.
All right, well, you're listening to Your Call. This is Ethan Alkind, and we're talking about the student debt crisis. If you have a student debt story to share, or if you have a comment about what you would like to see the Biden administration do, we'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation at 866-798 talk. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or we're on Twitter at yourcallradio. We're very pleased to be joined by Natalia Abrams, president and co-founder of Student Debt Crisis, and Whitney Barkley Denny, senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending. Whitney, to go to you to get a little more of a full picture of the kind of average or the makeup of the borrowers in this country of student loans. So another block that, of people that don't get as much attention are actually over 50 years old. And according to a piece from Insider this year, over 8 million borrowers over age 50 hold 22% of federal student debt. And they spoke in particular to David Wise, a 59-year-old who has over $236,000 in outstanding student loans. And he says that he made about $175,000 in payments over four decades. Yet when he graduated from law school, his debt only stood at about $75,000. And he said, "I feel like I've actually been responsible and I paid a considerable amount of money on my student loans, but it really is a debtor's prison." So Whitney, what do you make of stories like that? How representative is that of the overall block of borrowers, or at least senior borrowers?
Ethan, my stomach just dropped when you talked about that, because obviously there you have somebody who's also facing going into retirement with these loans, which is something we're hearing more and more of. A couple of years ago, actually, the Office of Older Americans at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau found that people over the age of 50 are the fastest growing demographic of Americans with student loan debt. And we're seeing that play out more and more. Some of this student loan debt is their own, like the gentleman you cited. We also have a lot of people who went back to college after 2008. Unfortunately, a lot of them enrolled in predatory for-profit schools that didn't end up actually serving them and have student loan debt from that. But we also have older Americans who are borrowing on behalf of their own children, and perhaps even borrowing on behalf of their own children while they themselves have outstanding student loan debt. And, you know, we sing the praises of most federal loan products at Center for Responsible Lending, but one we find really concerning is called a Parent Plus loan. And that's what a lot of parents are borrowing in order to make up the difference between what their kids are able to get in loan debt, or in loans rather, to go to school, and what the cost of education actually is. And these products, they don't have the same protections that other federal student loans do, but they have all of the same consequences. So while you can't get into an income-driven repayment program, or you can't, you know, get public service loan forgiveness with your Parent Plus loan, you certainly can have your Social Security garnished. And in fact, we're seeing senior citizens who are being pushed into poverty because their Social Security is being garnished in order to pay off that student loan debt.
And Natalia, did you want to weigh in on this issue of seniors or older Americans with student debt?
You know, I'm just very glad you're talking about it. And I co-sign what Whitney said of this being the fastest growing population. I know that the AARP has now taken this up as an issue because it impacts their members so much. And it's just, you know, even more of a struggle. I want, you know, anyone that is over the age of 55 that's thinking about retirement to know that there is, you know, help out there of repayment programs. And that can be really beneficial to know, in the sense that if you're not making money, if you're making $0, you could feasibly pay $0 a month and stay in good standing. However, you know, that debtor's prison concept that you were saying about the borrower, so many of the older Americans that we speak to, they just want to pay their loan back. They don't, you know, want to elongate it. And in fact, they might not ever be able to if they still owe that much at that point in their life. And it's just very disheartening. Mm-hmm. And yet another reason and argument to cancel student debt.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to the phone lines here. We have Adrian calling in from San Francisco. Adrian, welcome to Your Call.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me. I just wanted to point out, I'm someone that borrowed money for undergrad in the early to mid 1980s. That's how long the problem goes back, if not further. But my loan repayment rate was guaranteed to a bank at either 9.5 or 9.9%.
Wow.
And therefore, it took me, you know, 20 years to pay it off. But that was thanks to President Ronald Reagan and one additional factor in his hideous legacy against Americans.
Well, let me turn that comment over to Whitney. Whitney, is how common is Adrian's story here, and what can be done about it going forward if this kind of thing is still happening?
Absolutely. So there was really a sea change in the way student loans work in 2010, when these programs like Adrian described all became federal and under the Department of Ed. So we don't see that many of those older outstanding loans, but we do have some from the former, what we call the FFELP profile. I think what's important and to know is why we're talking about this now. It's because after 2008, when the financial crisis, you know, ran through state legislatures across this country, one of the places that they felt they could cut, in part because of guaranteed student loans, was funding to higher education. And so we went from having a system that mostly paid for someone to go to school, to go to college, to one that really relied on people to make their own way. And so that is why you do see sort of a generational shift between, you know, folks who went to school in the 80s and 90s and millennials who started going to school in the mid-2000s because of that divestment by the government. And I think for me, that really is part of the linchpin as to why we need to see some student loan debt cancellation. We support $50,000 in student loan debt cancellation across the board. It's because this is a problem that was really created by government divestment. And so it has to be a problem that the federal government can fix by reinvesting in students and canceling those student loans.
Mm-hmm. And Natalia, just any reactions to Adrian's story?
His interest rate was higher than it is now. We have seen, cheaper interest rates for student loans, for federal student loans, but not on the private loan side. And I think it just speaks to, we can't just address the interest rate down a little bit to end the student debt crisis. And he's absolutely right. This is a crisis that has been going on for a long time. I think the early 80s was kind of the beginning of that. We started to really go away from Johnson's initial plan to make sure that more people actually went to college and benefited from it. And those same people, women and people of color and, you know, Black Americans, got particularly hurt with the government and state disinvestment that Whitney was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And Whitney, before we go to break, I just wanted to follow up on a point that you brought up about wage garnishment and older Americans with student debt. And the Student Borrower Protection Center, a leading student loans advocacy nonprofit, recently published information that they obtained from a Freedom of Information Act request, where they found out that approximately $40 million in wages were garnished from student loan borrowers, even though wage garnishment has been prohibited during the pandemic. And they say those wage garnishments still haven't been refunded to borrowers. Do you happen to have any updates on this?
I don't have any updates on it, but I think it just really highlights, you know, the extraordinary powers of collection that come with these federal student loans for all their benefits. And again, they do have a lot. The collection, the power of collection that comes with them is really kind of overwhelming. And it, you know, we do see, as I said before, when we were talking about seniors, people being pushed into poverty because of those garnishments on their bank accounts in order to repay their student loan debt, even if somebody has been paying for 20 years and repaid their principal. So it's certainly something that we're concerned about, and certainly reform that we would like to see beyond $50,000 in forgiveness. Collections reform is at the top of our agenda.
And Natalia, do you have any comments? I noticed that your organization had retweeted this news. So any updates or comments?
I still have no updates, but, you know, wage garnishment is just so awful. They can take your Social Security up to 15%, I believe, of your Social Security that is not protected when it comes to student loan debt. And many people think it is, you know, your tax return, your income. And that is, you know, often you're paying more if you're in wage garnishment than if you were in a repayment program. So it's one of the reasons we at Student Debt Crisis do repayment workshops, even during these times of COVID, because people are so worried about what happens on February 1st. We believe that we want you to take care of your debt right now while we fight to cancel student debt and change the laws in the future.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Send an email to yourcall@kalw.org, or we're on Twitter at Your Call Radio. We'd love to hear from you, and we'll discuss the movement for student loan forgiveness just after this short break. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Call. Today, we're talking about the student debt crisis. And if you have a student debt story to share or a comment about what you would like to see the Biden administration do when it comes to student loan forgiveness, we'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send an email to yourcall@kalw.org. You can also reach us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. We would love to hear from you. And we're pleased to be joined on this program by Natalia Abrams, president and co-founder of Student Debt Crisis, a nonprofit organization dedicated to student loan debt reform. Natalia has been working on this issue for over a decade. And also we're joined by Whitney Barkley Denny, senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending, a nonprofit research and policy group whose purpose is to push for policies that curb predatory lending. Whitney works with state legislatures, attorneys general, and governors to fight predatory lending, exploitative student loan practices, and unscrupulous debt collectors. Well, I want to turn to the issue of student loan forgiveness. Now, during his campaign, President Biden promised that he'd offer some kind of loan forgiveness. For example, he proposed creating a program that would cancel $10,000 of debt for each year of national or community service so that people working at a nonprofit, for example, would be included in that program. Natalia, let me start with you. What are your thoughts on this kind of program?
I'm canceling $10,000 in student debt?
Yes, on President Biden's proposal.
Yes. You know, and I think it's good to point out that President or candidate Biden had said a bunch of different things. He had said $10,000 in immediate relief for COVID. He also said canceling the debts of those who attended public colleges and HBCUs who made under $125,000. That would imply lots more than $10,000. You know, student debt crisis and a lot of the organizations we work with, we just feel $10,000 does not go far enough. You know, when the servicers themselves have cost over tens of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of the loan and just, you know, these horrid mistakes, we definitely need to be providing borrowers as much debt as possible or as much cancellation as possible, which is why we also endorse, along with 415 other organizations, $50,000 or more. The one thing I will agree with President Biden on is that he needs to do it, and this needs to be done by executive action or on the administrative side.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the $50,000 forgiveness proposal, because Senators Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer, along with Representative Ayanna Pressley, have repeatedly called on President Biden to go further and cancel up to $50,000 for forgiveness for each borrower, because they agree with you that $10,000 does not go far enough. You mentioned you're part of the effort to support this. It's also been co-sponsored by over 50 members in the House and a number hundreds of grassroots groups. Ultimately, the plan would make 36 million borrowers debt-free. Whitney, turning to you on this question, I know you've signed on to this massive support coalition here to support, but using President Biden's executive authority to cancel federal student debt. So what are you calling for right now? Where is your organization in terms of its ask of President Biden?
Sure. We are absolutely still calling for $50,000 in student loan debt across the board. And I think that across the board is really, really important. As Natalia mentioned in his as candidate Biden, the president suggested, you know, canceling student loan debt for people who went to public school or HBCUs who make under $125,000. We would like to see $50,000 across the board without any income limits. And that's because we've really stopped thinking about this as an income issue and thinking about it more as a wealth issue. You know, it doesn't matter if you make $125,000 a year, if you're a first generation African-American student who's, you know, helping with his parents, who's maybe helping with his grandparents, and doesn't have the type of money that they need in order to start building wealth. And so we are still pushing for $50,000 across the board and hope to see it soon. We believe and we know that President Biden has the authority to do that.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the authority, because that is something that's controversial. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, for example, says that President Biden does not have federal authority to be able to forgive that much student loan debt. Are you able to kind of set the record straight here? Does the president have this authority to cancel that much debt? Can you do it by executive order?
Yes. So
yes,
he's actually. Oh, sorry, Natalia.
Yes. So just to resound from both of us.
I think I heard you harmonizing on that point. So.
Well, so, the
Whitney, let's start with you, and then
that,
Sure.
So he's already used that authority in order to extend the payment pause, right? So under the Higher Education Act, the government has the right to pay, compromise, waive, or release government-held student loans via the Department of Education. It's what Trump did when he first created the payment pause in the CARES Act, and it's what President Biden has used to continue extending the payment pause. So not only does he have the authority, he is already using that authority. And that includes, by the way, setting the interest rate to 0% during the pause. So we've seen two instances in which they've used this authority already since the beginning of COVID.
And Natalia, I know you agree, but anything else you'd want to add on his authority to cancel that much debt?
Yeah, we just know that ACLU, Harvard Law, Senator Warren, you know, they all believe that and know that we have the authority. And as Whitney mentioned, it is, I believe, Section 432A, for those that want to look into it, of the Higher Education Act, that does give the Education Secretary and the President the ability to modify, compromise, waive, or release any federal student loans and payments. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if it's incorrect, then we have, I believe it's even three presidents under President Obama as well, that have already used this action in some way.
All right. Well, I appreciate your bringing up those legal authorities for President Biden's potential action there. I wanted to go to a caller. We have Elizabeth from San Francisco dialing in. Elizabeth, welcome to your call.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just have a quick comment. I'm an immigrant, a mother of five children. I also went to school myself at 45. I'm owing some money. But at the same time, I want to say that my going to get an education was a positive experience for me that allows me at this age, I'm 55, to start my business and move on with my life. And I'm encouraging my children of five, whom four of them have graduated from college and have benefited from getting a federal loan. But at the same time, I, at this point, am still paying for my loan. I would really love to get a home. And so that when I retire, I'm working so hard to, and that education really benefited me, and I'm working so hard to pay that loan, at the same time trying to save to purchase a home so that I can retire and know that I'll be in my own home, and not depend on my children. And also my children, the four that have graduated, also have student loan that they are trying to pay. And my son, who is a second year in college, just last night we were talking about, you know, how is he going to pay for college? And I now have, I told him, well, I will have to help you. So, you know, we're working so hard. I just want those who are listening that we are trying so hard and
absolutely,
we want the education. I know the education will benefit us, but yet if it's working to help us out by just maybe the interest to come down a little bit or forgive the interest and just have us to pay back how much we borrowed or you know, just the interest.
Absolutely. Well, Elizabeth, I really appreciate you calling in and sharing your story, your family's story, and kudos to you, by the way, for going back to school and continuing with your education. I think that's very inspiring to hear. And I think you're really helping to kind of personalize what we're talking about today. Natalia, you must hear stories like Elizabeth's all the time. Do you have, you know, thoughts in response to how Elizabeth and her family could handle the student loan debt that they have?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think what Elizabeth really points out, and that's important for us to always point out when we talk about student debt, that, you know, the college, the education she received was worth it, you know, and she feels is incredibly valuable. We don't ever want to discourage people from going to college, quite the opposite. We want to just make that experience complete. And the fact that, you know, she's still, like so many Americans that we talk to, that are struggling to purchase a home, to purchase a car, to have financial independence, you're absolutely not alone, Elizabeth. And we hear these stories, all the time. And it's important that while we work to have, free college and cancel student debt, that we don't lose sight of the quality and value that so many Americans have received by going to college.
And Whitney, Elizabeth also mentioned the prospect of potentially forgiving the interest on the student loan debt. Do you have thoughts on that?
Absolutely. What we'd really like to see at Center for Responsible Lending, of course, after $50,000 in cancellation across the board, would be some reforms like Elizabeth mentioned. We'd like to see an end to compounding interest on these student loans. We'd like to see a change to income-driven repayment to make it actually affordable for folks. And we'd like to, make sure that Pell and other free programs are doubled so that people don't have to take out as much money to go to school in the first place. And that's, of course, the ultimate dream, which would be free college for everyone. But I did want to say that Natalia, the NAACP, ACLU, Generation Progress, and my organization, Center for Responsible Lending, we actually had a project earlier this spring where we collected over 12,000 stories like Elizabeth's to deliver to President Biden. And it's so interesting to see just across, ages, across races, across this entire country, folks are grappling with student loans pretty much in the way that Elizabeth is, feeling pride in their accomplishment, but also feeling really weighed down by the burden of now trying to start their lives or even start their retirement with this student loan debt looming over them.
All right. And so I want to thank Elizabeth for that phone call. We have a number of emails that have come in with different stories on student loans and the consequences. Kristen from San Francisco writes, I know it was recently announced that they will forgive loans for those who are on permanent disability, which is a step in the right direction. I find that many like myself are still stuck in a loophole. I'm a stage 4 cancer patient undergoing treatment that still allows me the opportunity to work from home and not be on disability. My illness is not curable. It's something I will live for the rest of my life with. However, I'm not ready to stop working until I have to. I'm spending thousands of dollars a year for medical reasons. And once the freeze lifts at the end of January, I'll be responsible for paying my student debt on top of other bills. I'm single, do not have the financial support of a partner, so it's hard to imagine what will happen. I would love to see more support for those who have chronic conditions but still work to make ends meet. Whitney, can you give any updates to Kristen? I know last month the Biden administration announced they would automatically cancel $5.8 billion in debt belonging to around 323,000 borrowers who are permanently disabled. But obviously for someone like Kristen, that doesn't encompass her situation.
That's right. I mean, this is definitely something that we need to be thinking about and talking about. I don't have any real updates. Unfortunately, it seems like the student loan conversation federally has stalled a little bit as we've been addressing other things. But I will say that there is a rulemaking coming up in October. This is a really funny little process that the Department of Education uses to make rules that people have to abide by. And disability forgiveness is going to be part of that discussion. So I think that that's a really important email. And I'm hopeful that that's something that we're going to see talked about more in the coming months.
All right. Well, so you're listening to Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about the student debt crisis, and would definitely love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. And you can also send an email to yourcall@KALW Radio or on Twitter. We're at Your Call Radio. We're very pleased to be joined today by Natalia Abrams, president and co-founder of Student Debt Crisis, and Whitney Barkley Denny, senior policy counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending. Let's go to another email comment. Paul from Oakland writes, we hear the stories and there's so much to be upset about the true victims of terrible student debt. Can we hear about the recipients or benefactors of the debt? There are too many people or investors who are benefiting from this situation. Who are they and how rich are they? Whitney, what can you help shed some light on this for Paul and other listeners with that same question?
Ooh, I sure can. I think that I would call the villains in this story the people who operate predatory for-profit schools that take advantage of borrowers who often are first generation, often don't have very much information about what it means to go to school, what it means to pay for school, and really provide them with educations that are just inferior, that aren't going to get them to where they need to be. I actually started my life in this work suing these schools, so it's a personal thing for me. In the case that I brought, we had a whole bunch of people who were training to be medical assistants who never got the training that they actually needed to pass state licensure and who were paying $20,000 for a program that they could have gotten at their local community college for a couple of thousand and probably have been covered entirely by Pell. We are really hopeful that the Biden administration administration is going to do more to rein in these predators. The Obama administration was moving in the right direction. And of course, under Betsy DeVos's Department of Education and the Trump administration, we really lost a lot of those gains. But we are starting to see some forward movement, including mass forgiveness of student loans that were borrowed in order to go to these predatory schools. But unfortunately, it's not enough. And California has led the pack in cracking down on a lot of these schools, but we also see a lot of them continuing to locate there because there are just so many students who they can entrap in their programs.
All right. Well, thank you for helping to shed light on the villain part of the story, as you described it. Let's go to Andre from Oakland calling in. Andre, welcome to your call.
Hi, how are you? Pleased to meet everyone. I have a problem with forgiving debt. Here's why. I never paid for any debt. It's either a merit scholarship or an athletic scholarship. Also, I'm in the military, so my kids use my benefits. Also, President Kennedy created a program. I can't remember the program. When you graduate from college, you volunteer for X time frame, and they'll forgive your debt. And the military also does the same thing. I'm not asking everyone to join the military, but there are so many options, but no one likes certain options. But yet, when the debt does come, that's when sticker shock happens. Now, junior colleges are an awesome because they have a trade school, and they are an entry point to a major university. But then you have to ask yourself, why am I trying to get to a major university? Is it to get a better job, or am I trying to be an academic scholar? Those are a couple of different approaches. Me, I have four doctorates. The Navy pay for all four. So I'm not seeing why my taxes should pay for someone who didn't plan their career or didn't maximize all of their educational options that are in front of them.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andre, I appreciate you bringing a different perspective to the call. I know you're talking about the public student loan forgiveness program. Natalia, do you want to talk about this program and how it's been working?
Sure. And real quick, I just think Andre brought up a good point, which is he doesn't want his tax dollars to pay for this. That's why we want student debt cancellation by executive order through administrative action. It won't come out of his taxes. This is not something that the taxpayers are going to have to pay for. This is money that has already been paid when we loaned out the money. We just wouldn't be collecting on debt. So that's a really important distinction. And then Andre mentioned the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. That was actually started in 2007 under the Bush administration. And the problem with that is that we are already 10 years into the program. Many people chose to do the right thing, as Andre put it, and work for 10 years in public service, only to have 99% of the claims denied in the first year of the rollout because they weren't in the correct loan program. They didn't have the correct repayment program. And there are giant craters in this program that made it very hard for people to believe it even existed. So, mm-hmm. You know, if we can, it'd be a miracle, you know, if we could correct all these programs and they worked as they were intended to, but even the programs that are good and set out to do the right thing end up harming borrowers, which continues to lead to this argument of canceling student debt.
Well, and just a few facts on the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Cumulative borrowers total over 1.3, almost 1.4 million. The borrowers who have submitted applications are about 250,000, and the number of applications approved are apparently less than 6,500. So definitely some challenges there. Whitney, did you also want to respond on Andre's point here?
Absolutely. I think I want to be a little bit more esoteric than Natalia because she hit some of the points that I would have hit otherwise. But I don't think that we want to see a higher education in the United States where only people who can qualify for an athletic scholarship or only people who can qualify for an academic scholarship are able to go. And I also think that we have to stop thinking about education as a specific return on investment for a specific field, right? It's fine if people want to go and get their HVAC certification. That's wonderful. But if you want to go get a broader education, if you want to go to a liberal arts school because you think that that's going to make you a better citizen, make you better able to, you know, vote wisely, make you better able to understand things, that's something that we should be supporting as well. I don't think that we want to create this stratified system in which people who are only people who are the most talented athletes or the most talented scholars or the richest people are actually able to access the types of education that they want. And so I think that we should be really, really careful when we talk about this and making sure that we are thinking about an education system that's inclusive of everyone.
All right. Well, thank you, Andre, for calling in with that. I also want to go back to this racial equity piece that both of you mentioned, and Natalia specifically following up with you on this. President Biden did sign an executive order last week that would make HBCUs, or historically black colleges and universities, more affordable. But a lot of advocates say that that's not enough. And according to some reports, black borrowers are five times more likely than white graduates to have default on their student loans. And that includes black students who don't complete college or who attend for-profit colleges. So can you just describe more about the racial disparities with student debt?
Yeah, and I think, and to add to that, I just heard last week that with black students, that the failure to complete is at 60%, which is almost 20% higher than the national average. And that's always important to talk about when we talk about student loan borrowers. These are not graduate, all graduates, people that have maybe taken a few classes, weren't able to afford completing college. And we know that one of the best ways that we can help bridge that racial wealth gap is to cancel student debt. It's one of the easiest levers that the federal government can take. It's not going to completely close it, but we know that it can help and be incredibly restorative for those borrowers that have been disproportionately impacted. I think, as you mentioned, taking 12 years or more than their white counterparts to pay off their loans if they do. The other thing from just so many friends that I've worked with that, you know, for black students, they feel that they have to often get graduate degrees or PhD degrees just to make the same salaries as their white counterparts that have bachelor's degrees or community college certificates. So, you know, it starts with paying more for, you know, to be higher, you know, highly educated, but then not seeing those results in salary increases.
And Whitney, anything just briefly to add on this point about racial disparities?
That's right. I think that it's really important that we understand this as a racial equity issue, that we understand it as the way that we are going to try to close that racial wealth gap and, you know, help people really make sure that education is working for them and not, as I said earlier in the broadcast, you know, actually increasing the racial wealth gap and stripping wealth from black communities.
All right. Well, let's talk just in the last few minutes that we have here about the root of the problem, which is really about the skyrocketing cost of college and education in general in this country. And student debt has made many people question if even college is worth it, given the extremely increasing rates of tuition. And so I'm wondering, Natalia and Whitney, but starting with you, Natalia, what do you describe the increase in the cost? What could be done to try to address this root cause of the problem?
Yeah, and I think this root cause is really what Whitney said earlier. It's state and federal disinvestment in higher education. Higher education budgets are not protected at the state level in the same way K through 12. So we've seen drastic cuts to higher education budgets, especially since the late 2000s. And, you know, we need to move. I'm in California, or we all are, excuse me. So I used to work with people across the country, but I'm in Southern California. In California, we had free college under the Clark Kerr Master Plan at, you know, all levels. We need to go back to a free college system. It's important to remember even high school at, you know, a point within the past century was not free across the board in America. Now we would think it's crazy to not have public high schools. We need to get to that same place with college. So it's free across the board.
And Whitney, anything just briefly to add on that point?
Absolutely. I think that we have to, as Natalia said, return to a place in this country where we see higher education as a public good that doesn't just turn out people who can do a specific job, but turns out people who can be better citizens and contribute more to their communities, who can buy houses and start businesses and buy cars and do all of the things that they need to do in order to add to their community wealth. And so, you know, understanding free college as a public good and understanding higher education as a public good is really the first step in that.
All right. Well, we just got about a minute left. So just for each of you, how can people get involved to make their voices heard on this? With the pause expiring on January 31st of next year, what's it going to take to extend that? And any final comments? So, Natalia, I'll start with you. Just a few seconds left here.
Yes. So Student Debt Crisis Center is doing all day seminar summit on September 21st, Tuesday, September 21st. Whitney will be joining us. So if you want to learn more about canceling debt, how to manage your debt, that's a great way to join us and learn how to get involved. And you can visit us at studentdebtcrisis.org.
All right. And Whitney, final comments from you on how to get involved?
Yeah. How many people listening here are constituents of Congresswoman Pelosi's? Call your legislators, call your senators, let them know that this is something that you're concerned about, that is something that you want to see happen, and that you know that President Biden has the ability to do this through executive action. The more pressure that we can get from Congress, the better. So start lighting up those phone calls and lighting up those phone lines in D.C.
All right. And we'll put additional resources on our website at yourcallradio.org. We're going to have to end it there, but I want to thank you both so much for joining us. We had Natalia Abrams, Executive Director of Student Debt Crisis, a nonprofit dedicated to reforming student debt in higher ed. Natalia, thanks so much.
Thank you, Ethan.
And also want to thank Whitney Barclay-Denny, Senior Policy Counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending. Whitney, thank you for joining us. And this is a reminder to return your vote-by-mail ballot by September 14th at 8 p.m. for the California recall election. Polls will be open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. that day. If you do not register before the deadline, you can still complete the same-day voter registration process and request your ballot in person at your county elections office or polling location. That's it for Your Call today. Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Twitter. We're at Your Call Radio and email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. And thanks also to Joanne Marr, our studio engineer. I'm Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Your Call.